The Sky News Centre at 5. Theresa May has revealed a new code of conduct for Conservative Party representatives in the wake of allegations of sexual harassment at Westminster. The Conservatives are also adopting a new complaint procedure. In a letter to the Speaker, the PM hoped other leaders would help her deliver a serious, swift cross-party response to the problem. Journalist Susie Boniface is appalled.
The fact that Theresa May has actually got to publish a code of conduct to show her MPs how they should and shouldn't behave is astonishing. How come they don't already know? How come they have to be told?
Meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn's under pressure to explain how one of his MPs took up a position on Labour's front bench despite claims of sexual harassment against him. An activist is thought to have made a complaint against Kelvin Hopkins up to 3 years ago. It's understood the Metropolitan Police is looking into sexual assault claims against Kevin Spacey. Earlier this week, he was accused of making advances on a 14-year-old boy in the 1980s. His publicist says the actor is seeking evaluation and treatment. Another news, a US Army sergeant who was captured by the Taliban after abandoning his post will not be sent to prison. Bo Bergdahl pleaded guilty to desertion, and President Trump had previously called for him to be executed. He's been demoted, but our US correspondent Cordelia Lynch says his punishment could have been much worse.
The prosecution originally were pushing for life in prison. They then reduced that to 14 years, so they will be disappointed by this.
The ashes of Ian Brady have been dumped at sea. The Moors murderer was cremated 5 months after he died. The Duke of Cambridge has praised the work of family liaison officers working with those affected by the Grenfell Tower fire. He met with officers as he attended the Metropolitan Police's passing out parade for new constables in Hendon in North London. And the FTSE 100 has just closed at a new record high. It's at 75.60. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Maggs.
This is BCFM 93.2.
If you want to come at me, come and ask me, Marvin, what have you done around reducing education inequalities in the city?
Sure.
What have you done about health inequalities? What are you doing about the structure of the economies?
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news. It's Green Councillor for Clifton Down, Carla Denyer, former teacher and founder member of the Counter Colson Group, Christine Townsend, and Dr. Roger Ball. We're hoping is arriving, arriving this very second, in fact, from the Bristol Radical History Group. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is lurking about too. After the 6 o'clock news, so we get different views this week on the notorious Balfour Declaration made at the height of the First World War that led to the creation of the Israeli state, as well as the Russian Revolution at the same time, started by Vladimir Lenin's journey from Basel to Switzerland, in Switzerland to St. Petersburg on a train, which began the Russian Revolution. 500 years ago this week, in the German town of Wittenberg, Martin Luther is said to have nailed his claims against the Catholic Church, which led to the Protestant Reformation and the Christian Church second great schism after the break between Orthodox Constantinople and Catholic Rome in 1154. On top of all that, our usual look at conflicts and underreported news around the world, such as the bomb dropped from a British jet on a marketplace in Yemen this week, which killed 30 people, nearly four times the number killed when pedestrians were mown down in New York. Just compare the coverage, folks. Plus Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, rainy this weekend. Highs again around 11, feeling cold with sunny spells, but breezy. Next week, highs of 11 again, feeling cold with plenty of sunny spells, some showers though, and breezy too. Next weekend, that's the 11th and 12th of November, highs around 10 Celsius with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, welcoming to the studio, Carla Denyer, and also Christine Townsend and Dr. Roger Ball. But before that, Marvin Rees, Bristol's Labour leader, was voted last year on the Corbyn wave to resist the Tory cuts. But does he really support the Labour leader? Is he more a David Miliband Labour man, or an Owen Smith, or even a Tony Blair, Thatcherite kind of Labour man? Well, one indication might be the way he told Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn to stay away from Bristol during the 2016 mayoral campaign last year. The power to manage this city has been taken out of the hands of councillors to a large extent and put into the hands of the mayor, in US style. But to whom does the mayor really owe his loyalty? To us, or to the usual well-heeled establishment suspects? Just how far away from Corbyn and close to Blair is Marvin? And what does it mean for Labour Party loyalists when the city votes Labour, but the mayor tells us we have to clean up our own streets, that the council will stop providing services? He threatens to close most of the city's libraries unnecessarily and gives nearly $100,000 secret bung to Anna Klonowski, the chief executive who's got rid of almost all the city's senior officers and their expertise. And whilst leading a march against the cuts, goes on to nearly double them. Is Marvin Rees confused about what party he represents, or is he having a laugh with us? One might be forgiven for wondering if we've seen this before in Labour with Tony Blair. Could Marvin, in fact, be a Tory-leaning mayor, like Blair, on a mission to make sure the Conservative dream of zero local government by 2020 becomes a reality? Climbing the greasy pole to a nice job in big business and on the global speaker circuit. For anyone that pays more than lip service to democratic accountability and transparency, there are lots of questions that beg an answer. After dozens of requests to Marvin's Director of Communications, Kevin Slocum, to Sam Eddy at the Mayor's Office and to the City Council Press Office, getting only one reply, which was an interview booked for 22nd of September, which Marvin pulled out of at the last minute, despite having been here in this very building, it's obvious Marvin's not prepared to answer my unscripted questions about how he's managing or mismanaging the £350 million or so of our money he's spending every year. After 18 months in the top job, why won't he sit here and tell us why he's doing what he's doing? Maybe he's too busy, maybe not, but something doesn't add up. Marvin makes frequent reference to his mum and great play of his family's humble working class roots here in St Paul's. But what happened to his dad? I've been treading the streets of St Paul's to ask about the father Marvin doesn't like to talk about. Who was he? Marvin's father, Valentine, I've been told, ran an unlicensed club in the 1970s on St Paul's notorious Grosvenor Road front line near the Black and White, called the Crystal Dove. Although best known as a West Indian cannabis den, the Crystal Dove was allegedly also a base for prostitution and dealing hard drugs. Marvin Rees's father, Valentine, it's alleged, was one of the biggest gangsters in the city at the time. Another well-known West Indian figure in St Paul's at the time in the late 1970s was a civil rights campaigner known as Balagoon. During these years of the IRA's mainland bombing campaign, Balagoon was giving speeches in solidarity with Sinn Féin's Republican anti-British establishment cause, both in Bristol and, more to the point, over in Ireland. Just after Margaret Thatcher's Tory government was elected in 1979 and the subsequent April 1980 riots, Valentine's alleged to have arrived at Balagoon's office and attacked the St Paul's civil rights leader with a machete. I'm told Marvin's father was arrested and charged for the assault, but in an initial court hearing, Valentine's lawyer asked for a recess, during which Marvin's father somehow alleged to have miraculously escaped from custody. What I've been told is that Valentine's been on the run ever since and is rumoured to have been sighted since in London, living under a new identity. It's not known if there's still a warrant out for his arrest. Why, you might well ask, might any of this be relevant to Marvin, the mayor of today? Why should the alleged sins of the father be revisited on the son? Well, of course, they shouldn't be. But this alleged backstory on Marvin's family, if true, could be used to threaten him. Do this or that, Marvin. Do that, Marvin, or we'll release the story about your father. Marvin was tapped up to go to Harvard, much as Bill Clinton was sent to be a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford. Does his fast track to leadership fit a pattern of individuals with skeletons in their closet, being selected by the establishment to be our political leaders, not just for their honesty and aptitude, but for their blackmail ability? Marvin Rees is now reported to be taking evening classes with a view to becoming an ordained vicar. But will he ultimately be reading the sermon in the Church of Jesus Christ or in the Church of George Bush and Tony Blair? Only time will tell. So anyway, I would like to just introduce Carla Denyer, who's a Green councillor. First of all, Carla, I just wonder what you make of, not of what I've just said necessarily, but of Marvin generally and his role as mayor compared to that of George Ferguson, for example, the previous independent mayor.
Thank you. Good evening. I can't really comment on those revelations because obviously it's the first time I've heard of them.
Allegations, revelations.
Yeah, quite. But yeah, my experience of him as mayor, I was initially quite optimistic. He seemed quite open. But I have to admit that in more recent months, especially, myself and my fellow Green colleagues have found that his talk about his door always being open is often not matched by his actions.
What about, quiet whether he is implementing what would be seen as Labour Party policies? I mean, this whole business of the potential to introduce council tax for people that don't actually have any money, that is expecting people to pay or potentially go to jail for not paying council tax when they actually don't have any money.
Yeah, that was completely shocking. So the Conservative councillors introduced a budget amendment back in only February of this year, which would have required the very poorest households in the city to pay more council tax, an increase which the rest of the city wouldn't have faced. And the Greens campaigned hard against it and voted it down, as did Labour. And then only less than 6 months later, Labour were proposing almost exactly the same policy. It was utterly astonishing. We've been campaigning against it alongside Acorn and other groups for about 3 months, and pleased to hear that there is now a U-turn and they're not going to propose it anymore, but only for this year.
That's right. And also, it's questionable about the legality of the consultation as well. So it may have been that Marvin was advised by the legal people at the City Council that actually the consultation was illegal. We better not introduce this.
Potentially. And that's one of the other things that we were campaigning hard on. So I did a bit of research when the consultation launched, and I found that a very similar consultation about the council tax reduction scheme put out by Haringey Council a few years ago was found illegal. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was found illegal for not laying out the alternatives to the cut sufficiently that any normal intelligent layperson could understand them. And as far as I can understand, Bristol was falling foul of the law in exactly the same way. Now, I didn't get as far as getting a formal legal opinion. They pulled a U-turn before I had the opportunity to do that, but I certainly was very concerned about it on both the legal grounds and moral grounds.
The other thing, which does seem to be not really a Labour policy, it seems to be maybe from another party to the right somewhere, is the library closure programme.
Yeah, and that's particularly galling because promising not to close the libraries was one of the grounds on which Marvin got elected.
So what should he be doing? If you were sitting in his chair, what would you be doing with the libraries? He will say, well, I've got to cut them.
He would, and he does frequently. I would be taking the fight to government much stronger than he is. He got the credit for leading the anti-austerity demo a few weeks or months now ago. But really, he didn't organise it. Bristol People's Assembly organised it, and he got the credit for organising it in exchange for walking at the front of it, which really irritated a lot of genuine anti-austerity campaigners who'd been putting their heart and soul into it for a while. And he hasn't been going to government and demanding more money and saying we're not going to cooperate otherwise. He's been going, at best, with a begging bowl and asking nicely.
I'm going to put this one to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. As a member of the Labour Party, Marvin is leading a march against the cuts, and yet we hear last week he's almost doubling the cuts here in Bristol, another £25 million extra this year, on top of the £30 million already announced.
Well, obviously, I can't defend Marvin's policies. He'll have to defend them himself, but I think the situation is actually quite difficult, whoever was in that chair, because unless you're going to set an illegal budget, which means they send in receivers...
George Ferguson didn't set an illegal budget,
No,
did he?
No, he didn't, but then the cuts... The screw continuously tightens. What George Ferguson did is he kicked the can down the road. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't arguments to be had. For example, I'm totally opposed to making people on low incomes pay council taxes. There's no sense in it, because the amount of money you're going to get from them, chasing them up just doesn't cover it. It just doesn't make any sense. It's a non-practical proposal.
Well, it's actually a vicious policy to ask people
yes,
to pay
is.
Money that don't have any.
Well, what we could do, I mean, I'd like to remind you of the early 1980s when Lambeth Council, where I was living at the time, and
I don't think anyone's suggesting we set an illegal budget.
Well, in that case, we've got to make some cuts. What are we going to cut, Tony? Perhaps you've got some ideas.
I'll just go to Dr. Roger Ball now, who's with us from Bristol Radical History. I wonder what you make of all this in the light of history, I suppose we could say, Roger.
I think, first of all, is that there's all this nonsense about we can't actually, always fit with we're set an illegal budget and, oh my God, we'll all be in prison and all this kind of nonsense. Like, the first thing to say is that, you're quite right. As he actually stood up and said he's not going to do the cuts, well, he hasn't actually done that, as far as I can see. He said that he's going to do the cuts. So why is he leading an anti-austerity demo? Oh, well, the problem of obviously lies in Parliament, he says. But you could easily do some stuff. I mean, a couple of strategies. First of all, you could actually borrow money and you could set an illegal budget and challenge the government. I mean, I believe a Tory council has been the only one that actually challenged this government, didn't they, by saying they would increase the council tax, and then they were given leave to do that. Yeah, well, so, I mean, that's a good start, isn't it? I mean, other things I would do is I would immediately try and take out a load of things that are actually going to hurt some people who are wealthy. So I'd take out the old Vic, I'd shut down the arena, I'd actually go after some stuff that isn't going to cut respite care.
Actually, he's done
people.
That, hasn't he? The arena is not...
Well, I don't know, is it? Now. I don't know, it's just sitting there, isn't it? I mean, my attitude is that you can actually, if you needed to, you could make cuts which would damage the city, there's no question, but I'd much rather damage some arts institutions and stuff like that than I would damage people getting respite care for their, you know, for their children with learning difficulties or something, which is where he's been at for the last few years.
Christine Townsend, what do you make of this? I mean, I think there's this kind of, on the one hand, it seems to be I'm campaigning against the cuts. On the other hand, Marvin is actually increasing the cuts, nearly doubling them this year.
Well, and Marvin also apparently did go to Parliament and was going to meet members of, you know, members of the Cabinet and Tory MPs, and nobody turned up. And it was just this complete farce whereby he goes to London and he doesn't actually speak to anybody. And it's finger pointing, saying we didn't get invited and I did invite you, but you didn't turn up. It's there's some PR going on. There's some cover ups going on. There's stories being put out into the media that is designed to give a presentation of what Marvin Rees is actually doing, and it is about choices. If there are cuts that need to be had, it's about who and where those cuts fall. I don't agree that libraries should be shut, but if you are going to shut a library, you shut Redland Library and you shut Clifton Library, and you shut the libraries in the areas that vote Tory, because it's the Tory government that are bringing the austerity down the motorway to us, and so it's those that vote Tory in the city that are going to be on the receiving end of the cuts. And whilst that's not going to be a perfect picture across the city, I accept that, people that vote Tory need to feel it, is this, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and it's really noticeable that while Marvin was facing cuts from funding from national government, that those funding cuts didn't come with instructions to specifically cut the council tax reduction scheme. That was the Labour administration's choice to focus on them rather than on other council services. I just wanted to say as well about the trip to London. So Marvin asked that Caroline Lucas also go to that event on behalf of the Greens and other supportive MPs and the anti-austerity agenda. And he was liaising on that through myself and Green Councillor Fee Hance. And 2 days before that trip to London, he still hadn't told Caroline where or when the meeting was taking place. And she had a full day of meetings, including sessions in Parliament. And we were chasing, saying, look, the leader of a political party can't keep her diary free for an entire day for you, Marvin. When is this happening? In the end, she couldn't come because she didn't get notice in time. Now, I have no idea if that's the same as what happened with these ministers who supposedly snubbed him, but it's entirely likely.
It's just as well she didn't go, really, because it didn't seem like there was any meeting at all.
Well, it was a load of Labour MPs and Labour mayors congratulating each other, but nobody else, apparently.
Yeah, and also, I want to know about why there's a 13% increase in executives' pay in Bristol City Council that's just gone through. Why is that happening? I mean, you know, ordinary employees have not been given a decent pay rise for years. So why a 13% increase for executives? And why do we continue to engage in public-private finance initiatives through the council and with, like, private consultants operating within the council? They're a fortune. They cost a fortune and they don't do anything most of the time. So, you know, I don't understand. He's got a real clear-out, and his idea of a clear-out was to remove officers that he was in a battle with, as far as I can turn out, or officers that should have been held accountable for the hiding of the £30 million worth of budget cuts that were in the last administration.
I mean, I wonder if the bung to Anna Klonowski has been reported to the police, because that's
70 odd grand, wasn't it?
Yeah, 90. They're now saying 90. They reckon £92 million.
How long was she there?
Over 6 months.
Yeah.
How long was she in there?
Just over 6 months.
6 months.
Keep an eye on the news early next week. My colleague Paula O'Rourke, the Green Councillor on the HR committee, has been asking questions and poking around to try and find out more about that. And I can't tell you any more right now, but you might hear something about it on the news.
Yes, I mean, Martin, what do you make of this? Ex gratia payments. It looks as if this has just been made because Anna was brought in to do a particular job, reorganise everything, up certain people's pay, get rid of others, and she's done it and she's now been paid off.
Well, I have no real comment to make because I don't know enough. When George Ferguson, when he was on here last week, suggested that she didn't, in fact, go voluntarily. I don't know where he's got that idea from. I simply don't know enough about it to say. Can I just mention in your earlier presentation about Marvin's father, I've known about that for years. And people who know Marvin have known about that for years. And what he said to me must be 7 or 8 years ago now, he said, everybody in St Paul's knows who my dad was. I don't make a deal out of it. I don't deny it. Yes, he was a gangster, but I've had nothing to do with him since I was a small child.
Interesting, though, the business of the connections with the IRA and this assault on
The assault was carried out by his father on a civil rights activist because he was a gangster. But you've got to remember that Marvin's had nothing to do with his father since he was a small child.
Well, I think I made that...
He thoroughly disapproves of everything he stands for.
I think I made that point, actually. But anyway, Carla, you also wanted to mention something about the selling off of public space, because that's obviously a way you can help balance the books, is to get the assets that Marvin and the council are holding on our behalf and flog them off.
That's right. There has been a bit of selling off of the family silver. And I don't have a problem with strategic selling off of land and property that's not being used if the council can use that money better. That's fine. What I'm particularly worried about at the moment is public space and what rights the public have to do what they want in that space. So there's a lot of developments going through planning at the moment which would sell off council-owned roads, squares, courtyards, that kind of thing, to a private developer who would develop buildings around it, and they would also run and maintain those public spaces, and they wouldn't really be public spaces anymore. It's like Cabot Circus at the moment. It looks public, but the minute you get your camera out, you start a protest, you hand out some leaflets, you look a bit too scruffy, then you're out on your ear.
Also, I noticed this week we're seeing central government proposals to give private security like G4S and Serco the right to arrest people.
Yeah, and there's a petition on that. I encourage everyone to look it up and sign it.
Is the petition going to get anywhere? Because if they want to give them the power to arrest, they will do. I mean, anyway, why shouldn't they have that power?
Well, given how G4S and Co. have behaved whenever else they've been given any scrap of power, I don't trust them an inch with that, I'm afraid.
Martin,
and I know that a petition won't necessarily solve anything, but it's a good place to start.
Martin, do you think it's okay to hand over power to arrest to people like G4S and Serco?
Absolutely not. Why do you presume that I was going to say anything else?
I mean, because there are security guards all over the place now. A lot more of the place is patrolled by private security rather than the police.
Well, it shouldn't be, should it? That's all I'll say.
So if someone is committing a crime in Cabot Circus, should the private security there not be able to arrest them?
They shouldn't be. They can't arrest them because that's a legal procedure, and it's only police officers who should have the power of arrest. Security guards have not and should not have that power.
Roger, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, obviously, this is slow privatisation of all sorts of things, all sorts of activities of the state, and, you know, absolutely not. I mean, the whole point of the idea of the citizen, which we never really engage with in this country, is that you have free access to public space. And, you know, a long time ago, you're quite right to bring up Cabot Circus, all this privatisation of roads and areas. Like, you know, it was a small start about 10 years ago, but now it's expanding. And that goes along with, in the US model, with the increasing powers for security guards and private security agencies to protect wealthy areas. I mean, that's sort of fairly normal in some areas of, you know, major cities in the US in wealthy areas. They have private security guards who can seem to be able to arrest or even shoot people and get away with it.
Also, Christine Townsend, one of the things that's being privatised bit by bit is our education. Even though the taxpayer is still paying for it, it's being managed by private companies. Can you just tell us the extent of that nowadays in the city?
Well, the academisation programme has almost entirely taken over our secondary state system. We have one school now in the secondary system that is still local authority maintained, and that is a Church of England school, which were slightly differently operated anyway.
Where's that?
St Mary Redcliffe.
Okay.
And just under 50% of the primary sector has also gone over to become academies. It's one of the highest primary sector academisation in the country. So Bristol is way over when it comes to academisation, and we've also got a number of free schools which are also similar to academies in the sense that it's sponsors and individuals that are running rather than the local authority.
So it'd be fair to say that Bristol's sort of leading the way in getting rid of its schools from local authority control?
Bristol has gone wholeheartedly into the academisation programme. 2003 was the first academy, the City Academy, which was St George, changed its name. And since then, we've seen both feet deep end, and Bristol's gone straight down the academy route. And we are beginning to reap the benefits of that in terms of academies now demonstrating themselves to be failing our children when it comes to the education standards that they are being able to maintain.
Okay, can you take us through some of that?
Well, the most recent one was last night. There was a report in the Post about Merchants Academy down in South Bristol that is inadequate. So we now have two secondary schools in the city that are inadequate. And it's frightening, actually, that that particular school has gone into is become inadequate. Barton Hill, sort of 4 weeks ago, was reported as inadequate. The Kingfisher School is inadequate. Luckwell, which is in South Bristol, is also inadequate. Baydocks Wood. So they're coming down the line where we're getting grade four from Ofsted, where they were grade two, where they were good.
They would say, actually, that this was just the same before the academisation. Actually, Bristol's secondary schools particularly were failing.
But the academisation programme was supposed to make education better. That was the whole point of it. That's what we've been sold on. It's been continuously repeated at a local level, particularly by the politicians, about how great the academisation programme has been in Bristol. And actually, I looked today, we've got 16 local authorities in the South West. Bristol's 14 out of 16 in GCSE results. You know, it is somewhat of a myth that the academisation programme has miraculously transformed education in the city. It hasn't done that.
Carla, what do you make of it? I mean, I know you're not actually, as councillors, in charge of, or even Marvin, in charge of these schools anymore.
But no, it's weird. I mean, I think this is less important, frankly, than the quality of the education. But a weird quirk of the mass academisation of schools is that the local authority is still responsible for the school's admissions process and is responsible for making sure there are enough school places every year in the city, but has no powers to make sure that there are enough school places. It's completely ridiculous. And there's literally nothing we can do about it.
Is that right, Christine?
Yes, that is right. And the local authority is also responsible for safeguarding of all children, regardless of the type of school they're in, including the independent sector. They are responsible for all children that have special educational needs. And they're also responsible for children that are looked after by the local authority, because the authority is the corporate parent. There are levers that exist still within the education law and the education structures. Bristol has chosen not to be using these. And for me, it's about there is a political lack of expertise around education, and part of that, I believe, is that we have a generation of councillors that have come on stream since academisation, whereby they've believed the myth that they can't do anything about it.
It does sound to me, from what you're saying, as if most of the difficult things that schools do, in other words, coping with children with learning difficulties, actually have been left to the local authority to carry on doing that. The easy bits have been handed to the private companies that are now running these, or charities that are running the schools.
I would completely agree with you. And what actually is happening on the ground is that schools, I'm also seeing this in my paid job, and I'm seeing it in work that I do that I don't get paid for, is that we're seeing unlawful exclusions, because there is no such thing as can you take your child home for the rest of the day? You either exclude the child or you don't, but children are being sent, parents are coming in and they're being asked to pick their children up for half a day and, you know, don't bring them back tomorrow, let them cool off. So we're also seeing this explosion of unlawful practice. Children are, you know, they're being brought back into school with their parents, and parents are being suggested that maybe there's another school that they should go to, or maybe they should they should think about home educating their children. The number of home educated children has gone through the roof in the city, and this is about the pressure that schools are putting on individual families who are already under stress, particularly if their children and have additional needs.
Yeah. I mean, what do you make of all this, Carla? Because I think there does seem to be an understanding now that city councillors don't really have any power anymore, that Marvin has all the power. And so, I mean, you see, not only is that happening, but you've also had the schools, the power to manage the schools taken away from the council too.
Yeah, yeah. Since Bristol's had a mayor, the council, most councillors have had at best soft power to influence, very little hard decision making power.
But we've had the budget, haven't we, recently, which is supposed to be voted on by everyone. Everyone has to get behind the budget.
Yes, but Labour have an absolute majority in Bristol now, so they can ignore anything that any of the other parties said, which is what happened to us. We put forward four amendments that would have lessened the impact of the cuts, and Labour were whipped to vote them all down.
So what were they?
Remember. Now you're testing me. It's
back I know.
There were two amendments that would have added up to 1.7 million, which were the money would have been achieved by paying back loans at a slower rate, but at a rate that was still affordable. And that money would have partly gone into funds that help prevent homelessness, crisis funds, and into the library service, which obviously would only have been a one-off year thing, but it would have given them longer to come up with alternatives rather than just closing them. And we also had a couple of smaller amendments, one of which is really small but seemed like a no-brainer, which is that councillors get free car parking. And staff don't, and employees at most other city centre workplaces don't. And we thought that councillors should give that up. It should go over to pay and display parking, and that would have saved about £20,000 a year, which would mean one less person didn't need to be made redundant. But almost all the other councillors voted it down.
Gently encouraging them to get on their bikes. Also, of course, we've just heard as well that councillors, it says in the Bristol Post, I'm not sure how many councillors that is, want to move Bristol Central Library to the galleries or to Colston Hall. The council is, of course, proposing at the same time to close 17 of the city's libraries. Now, we had the school, didn't we, the nearby school. What was it?
Cathedral Primary School,
moving into part of the Central Library, and now we're talking about closing it completely, Carla.
Yeah, this is very odd. Labour are the administration. I don't know why they're sort of leaking plans via the Post rather than just talking to their mayor. This is, I didn't know anything about this until it was in the Post. This is just six Labour councillors, mostly, I think, but not entirely backbenchers, who've come up with this idea at the 11th hour that the council should sell off the historic Central Library and put a library into Broadmead. Now, a library in Broadmead in itself isn't necessarily a bad idea, but it sounds like it's sort of trashing the historic building and in
now,
the process.
Down in Bridgewater, they've got their annual wonderful carnival tomorrow, which is a sight to behold. And I think I would be surprised if half of Bristol goes down there to enjoy it, because we're getting nothing like that up here. In fact, businesses have been asked to pay for the Christmas lights in Bristol this year. The council has cut the £36,000 funding to the lights. They went up around the city centre weeks ago, used in a TV ad, but the city council has pulled the £36,000 funding because of the incredibly difficult financial situation. I just wonder, you know, why is it that we have to go to Bridgewater to have a good evening out? You know, I mean, it just seems amazing to me. One of the major owners and controllers of the schools around here is the Merchant Venturers, and you were, I'm not sure if you were there as well, Roger, at the annual Colston Society service, I think it was, in St Mary Redcliffe Church. Just tell us about that.
So myself and Rolls went down there. It was at St Mary Redcliffe Church. They had St Mary Redcliffe Primary School children in there, and they had St Mary Redcliffe Secondary School children in there. The Colston Society is one of their philanthropic charities that they hide behind to do their good work from. There were five police officers at one point outside the church, and I was followed around the building by what I can only describe as church heavies. It was pathetic, the response that the church had. I don't know who they thought was coming down and what we were going to do. We were two middle-aged women with a chalkboard and some writing paper. I mean, you know, and It was quite farcical, to be honest, to see the kind of response that they had. But clearly, the church and the merchant and this Colston Society, who a lot of Merchant Venture is obviously part of, they're very they're a bit spooked by the fact that people are asking questions and it's being covered in the local press, and that actually they're having to be a bit more transparent, and they're being challenged around what they're doing. And they can't really answer why they're doing it. And also, because these things are happening in historic Bristol churches, the diocese is also showing themselves to be wrapped up in this as well, and condoning what is going on inside these buildings. And I was amazed, because I got in there half an hour before, and they had hundreds of buns lined up for the children. It was quite astonishing, actually.
It also all happening apparently on anti-slavery day,
yes,
as well.
Exactly.
Couldn't make it up, could you?
No, you couldn't make it up. I actually don't think they realised, which for me,
it's worrying.
Yes, is, you know, and this is the diocese that, so say, is kind of reflective and understanding of its impact that it has on the city. I don't actually think they realised they were doing it on the same day.
Carla, what do you make of this? Because there seems to be a little bit of a strange reaction in Bristol to the whole legacy of Edward Colston's slavery, whereas in Liverpool they've kind of faced up to the past. They've got the whole exhibition there about what the slave trade in Liverpool was. But here in Bristol we're still having these church services in St Mary Redcliffe and in the cathedral commemorating one of the biggest slavers of the lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a massive fan of the Countering Colston campaign. Christine, Roger, and also Cleo, one of my fellow Green councillors, I think they're doing great work and getting a lot of press for it, which is well earned.
So why is it still going on here, do you think?
Who knows?
It always seems to me like a kind of Gormenghast, the Mervyn Peake books, where they just go through these rituals without actually even thinking what they're doing. But we've got another one coming up soon, haven't we? It's the Charter Day.
Oh, it's the big one, yes. Yeah. So we'll have all the merchant adventurers in the cathedral. We have the three secondary schools that the merchant adventurers run, two of which are now state schools, of course, so that makes it everybody's business, because it's our money that they are using to educate those children. And then after they've had their big ceremony in the cathedral and they give the children their buns again, those merchants then go up to Merchants Hall, which is on the promenade in Clifton, and they have a big slap-up dinner, and that's when they announce who the new president is and all the rest of it. Yep.
The new master, yeah.
And whatever they call it.
I noticed this similarity, and I've said this a few times, but with the Freemasons, where they have the master from the one year, they have a senior warden who's going to be the master next year, and the junior warden who's going to be the master in 2 years' time, exactly like the Masonic lodges. And it does start to sound like this is sort of eulogising Colston and an obsessive kind of ancestor worship kind of fashion, without actually thinking of who was this guy and what he did. And they're absolutely indignant. Denial about saying, actually, Edward Colston, maybe a bit of a dodgy character. Anyway, Roger, what do you make of all of this? And when is this event at the cathedral that they don't like people to go to?
Well, I think the first thing to say is I never thought history was so dangerous. Like, if you were chasing you around St Mary Redcliffe Church with church heavies and police. But but it clearly is contentious. I mean, that's the point. The first thing to say is that, yeah, there are a number of ceremonies. Obviously, we had the commemoration day today. Then we've got the charter day. On November the 10th, which is Friday, November the 10th. And then there's also St Stephen's Church ceremony, which comes after that, when the merchant adventurers march down Corn Street. I mean, the point about all this is, I mean, I said sort of a couple of years ago when we first started deep research into Edward Colston, that, you know, the biggest problem here is that if you bang up statues and make the bloke the city father and name the whole city after him, you've got a problem if history doesn't connect with what you've portrayed him as. And I think that's the difficulty we've got here. I mean, I've got to say, extremely angry when I read about the fact that Colston Girls' School is not going to change its name now, apparently, it's claiming. First of all, because it wasn't very clear, I heard on Radio 5 this morning, that an interview with somebody from the school, it wasn't clear about who was making that decision. They were kind of playing around with the idea that the pupils had made that decision, which I find laughable, considering the Society of Merchant Ventures basically run the school. So the first question is, who's making the decisions? I think the second thing that's really important is that last night we were in the pub and we were making a list of all the schools in Bristol that have had their names changed in the last sort of 10-15 years due to the academisation process, which is most of them. I mean, Monk's Park, the Orchard School, Withywood School becomes a Merchants Academy. You run through a whole list, there's loads of them. They're sort of named after businesses now. I mean, Oasis this and Oasis that. I mean, the first point to say is that there was no, you know, what the site merchant has changed the name of these schools without, you know, did they consult the local population? Did they care about people's memories? The tens of thousands of people who, you know, working class Salisbury Stones have been through those schools and what their memories of those schools and whether they care about them. No, they change the names like confetti.
Well, it's a bit like a company. It's a bit like a company rebranding or something. They do this.
Yeah, yeah. But they say it all the time. And it comes to their schools, which apparently have got this great tradition or something. You know the Colston schools. Then suddenly it's a real problem. Oh dear. But actually, I'd like to point out that the vast majority of those academy schools, I think all of them weren't named after a slave trader. So I don't see what the problem is here. Why is it their school named after a slave trader can't be changed, but everybody else's schools they'll change the name of without consulting anybody? I mean, that's ridiculous.
What about it might be stretching your point to talk about ancestor worship, although you could see the way that the merchants sort of bow to the altar when they go into the cathedral is a little bit weird, you know. What about relics of John Cabot and Edward Colston? Might they collect and revere those? Is there any evidence to that? I would imagine not.
Yeah, well, I mean, a long time ago, there was rumours around the hair and nails of Edward Colston, which were apparently taken from his body when the corpse was disinterred in the 18th century or something. And for many years, people said, oh, it's just laughable. There's no way they would keep something like religious relics in their headquarters. But it turns out it's true. I saw the photograph actually earlier this year, you know, of somebody had been up at the hall and was shown the hair and nails. And also, I know, Christine, noticed essays written by pupils going on about that these things were disgusting when they were shown them, and that was actually on the website for Colston Girls School. So the point is, they do exist, and there is, yes, definitely this idea of, I mean, it goes along with the whole creation of Edward Colston, which was a Victorian thing really, which was to create him as two things, or to portray him as two things: the merchant prince, you know, the leader of the great trading empire that came out of Bristol, and secondly as the moral saint. That was the other thing they tried to portray him as. I would argue certainly on the moral saint level he's got a bit of a problem with his history. I mean, 85,000 people transported and 20,000 dead, including 3,000 children, is not really moral saintly behaviour.
Certainly not. So, Christine, when is this the Charter Day service, and what will the Counter Colston Group be doing?
The Charter Day is a week today, November 10th, so in and around the birthday of Edward Colston, although, of course, they would deny that that's what they're actually remembering. We'll be down outside the cathedral suggesting to the children that maybe they have a little think about the bun and why they're getting their bun, because it's quite clear, speaking with children, that they don't understand what they're doing. And the thing is that children have assemblies every week. Sometimes they will have more than one assembly. These children may go to the cathedral a couple of times in their school career. They're not going to necessarily remember the words that people are speaking to them, but they will remember the fact that they went in a building and they had a cake. And that's where it becomes an emotional connection, because the children themselves are, that's what they will remember. And it becomes part of their own self-identity. And this is what I meant when I wrote the word brainwashing, because it becomes when things become part of your own self-identity, you have an emotional connection to it. And I think that it's so ingrained within the Bristol population that this man was this great philanthropist, that when people are actually challenged with the reality, and that is, there's evidence then that's put in front of them where it demonstrates that that isn't the case, they find it really, really difficult, because you're challenging their sense of self.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this is really seems to be largely to do with the takeover of our secondary schools, many of our secondary schools, by a society that doesn't have open public accounts, the Society of Merchant Venturers, and that is simply not transparent, a bit like we were saying about Marvin earlier on.
Well, I think it's... If private schools have a private arrangement to use the cathedral, it's very difficult to see how they could be stopped from doing that. But as Christine pointed out earlier, some of these schools are actually funded by public money. Now, at that point, I would have a question in my mind, and my father was a head teacher for 40 years, what are they doing in the church that day when they should be doing the national curriculum or whatever they're supposed to be doing? That is actually an abuse of public funds.
Children in themselves being taken by their school to places of worship is not a problem. But what's a problem is that those schools don't want to share what's going on inside. That's the issue. And I agree with Martin. When the merchant venturers only ran private schools, it was between those that were paying for it and the merchant venturers themselves. But now it's public money that's being used, and these traditions and these sort of rituals are continuing to be carried on. The public have a right to know what's going on, and that's the questions that we are asking. And the thing is that education is about critical thought, and the children that are attending these schools need to be encouraged to think critically about the experiences that they're being given by the people that run the schools.
Okay, well, that's a good way of looking at things and a way to take things forward. Potentially, Carla, what do you think we should be doing in the city in the future with this issue of the merchant venturers' control of schools and things like these services, where effectively the children are being potentially told things? I mean, when I went in there and recorded a conversation from Bishop Mike when he was giving his sermon to the children, he was saying that it was just speculation, all the criticism of Edward Colston as a slave trader.
Yeah, that's shocking. To be honest, I didn't know much about this until recently, until Countering Colston brought it out into the light for everyone to see. But I completely agree with Christine that this kind of associating Edward Colston with a nice memory of being given a cake is brainwashing, pure and simple. And it's quite clear what they're trying to do there.
But it's tradition. Why? It's tradition. It's been going on for hundreds of years.
So's FGM. But I don't see anyone in Bristol defending that. So has, you know, domestic violence. So has racism. You know, all of it. Just because something is a tradition doesn't mean that it's defended. It's defendable.
And to be honest, I'm not arguing against the cakes. I'm arguing against the veneration of this almost saint-like character. They can keep the cakes and give it another reason in modern times if they want to.
Roger, what do you think we should be doing?
Well, I think the first thing is that, as I mentioned earlier, with the idea of changing names. I mean, I heard somebody from Colston Girls' School on Radio 5 this morning saying that, you know, that this was, again, you know, raising history if they took the name of the school off. You know, and I've got to say again, I mean, this argument about raising history is somewhat nonsensical. History's in books. Right, that's where it sits. And what you decide to commemorate, memorialise or celebrate is taken out of those history books. So my attitude is taking Colston out of the limelight now in Bristol, which, you know, is long overdue, to be honest. I mean, it's this cult has dominated the city for too long. You know, it's not a problem. It's not raising history at all. You can go read about Colston in any history book. You know, so that, you know, in order for me to find out about great Bristolians who stood against slavery, I've got to go to the library. So, you know, to be honest, I haven't got a problem with that. I think it's a nonsensical argument. And also what was pointed out on Radio 5 this morning, which is, you know, somewhat good, was that the idea that they were saying, okay, we're not going to, the guy from Colston Girls says, we're not going to celebrate Colston anymore, we're going to keep the name. And, you know, the interviewer said, well, isn't that a bit of a contradiction? If it's a toxic brand, surely you want to change the name of the school. And I'd love to see the people like the Society of Merchant Ventures who are making these decisions about these schools step up to the mark, right, and recognise that it's time for change, just like they thought it was time to change the Monk's Park to Orchard School.
Or St George to City Academy when John Laycock, the merchant venturer, became the chair of governors.
Yeah, or Witherywood to the Merchants Academy. I mean, who made those decisions? Why can't they step up to the plate and make the decision?
The concept of name changing when it comes to schools is something the merchant venturers has done. So what they are doing is defending the fact that it's named after a mass murderer. It's quite a difficult position. And the other thing that we found really difficult is that the merchant venturers hide behind gatekeepers and they hide behind message senders. These people will not... Have you been able to get anybody from the merchant venturers to come and speak? These people hide behind
which is Chris Curling,
their
the master,
paid help. It wasn't a merchant venturer on the radio this morning. It was the hired help. It was the head teacher. They will not come and justify and speak about what they're doing. And that is a huge problem.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's just go to Westminster now and to Prime Minister's questions this week, where Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition, was asking why it is that the rich pay no tax.
Mr. Speaker, if we are leading the world, perhaps she could explain how the amount of tax paid by the super rich in income tax has fallen from 4.4 billion to 3.5 billion since 2009. Earlier this year, the Public Accounts Committee said the HMRC record of getting multimillionaires to pay their taxes was, and I quote, dismal, and that the super rich were getting help with their tax affairs that is not available to other taxpayers. our schools' budgets are being cut. More people waiting longer for treatment on the National Health Service. More elderly and disabled not getting the social care they need. Does the Prime Minister think it is acceptable that when it comes to paying taxes, there's one rule for the super rich and another for the rest of us?
The top 1% of earners in this country are paying 28% of the tax burden. That is the highest percentage ever under any government. Honourable gentleman is wrong. Over the next 2 years, £2.5 billion extra is being put into our schools as a result of decisions taken by this Conservative government. But I'll tell him, he talks about spending on schools and hospitals. I'll tell him where the real problem lies. Today we spend nearly £50 billion in payments on interest to those we have borrowed from as a result of the legacy of the Labour Party. That is more than we spend on the NHS pay bill. It is more than we spend on our core.
Order, order. The Prime Minister's answer will be heard.
We spend £50 billion on debt interest every year. Payments to people we've borrowed from. That's more than the NHS pay bill. It's more than our core schools budget. It's more than we spend on defence. That's a result of the economy we were left by the Labour Party in government. Gentleman want to do? He wants to borrow £500 billion more that would make the situation worse and mean even less money for schools and hospitals.
Well, where does one begin with Theresa May's obfuscations there? When we talk about people paying taxes and they say that the wealthy pay most tax, which of course they tend to do so because they've got the money, people are forgetting indirect taxes, tax VAT. Taxes on cigarettes, alcohol, these are paid by ordinary people and are actually a very big chunk of what the government spends. So focusing on direct taxes is missing the point to some extent. And of course, it's irrefutable.
But that's what Jeremy Corbyn was doing. He was focusing on direct taxes.
No, he was focusing on direct taxes, but I'm just making the point that the idea that only the wealthy pay tax is simply wrong. Every time poor people go to the shop, they pay tax, but they don't realise that they're paying it. And, of course, that's where a lot of the government's money comes from.
But £50 billion repayments for Labour's loans.
All right, now let's just come back to that. When Gordon Brown, along with George Bush, rescued the banking system in 2008, the Tory opposition...
Actually, Gordon Brown saved the world.
Oh, yes, he saved the world. Of course he did. I've forgotten about that. But I'm just pointing out that the Tory opposition supported the bailout of the banking system. Now, in actual fact, you were following a free market policy, you let the banking system collapse. That's what Austrian school economists believe. And, of course, the right wing of the Tory party claim to be Austrian school economists.
Martin, this is England, not Austria.
Well, this is it. Austrian school, I said, Tony. I didn't say Austria. Now, the fact of the matter is that nobody across the mainstream political spectrum was prepared to tolerate the collapse of the banking system. Now, of course, if you're a free market economist, the banking system collapses and then capitalism spontaneously regenerates. But nobody really believes that it would. If the banking system collapsed, there'd be social chaos, civil war, and possibly revolution. And that's why you've got to bail the banking system out. And that's where that's why we owe money. We bail the banks out, and we borrow the money from the banks because the banks create the money. Then we've got to pay the money back to the banks for the money that they've lent us to pay back what they've lost.
Here's a simple question for you. They're creating hundreds of billions of pounds in quantitative easing. Yeah. Why can't that money just be used to pay off these loans?
Well, that's been suggested that instead of quantitative easing, you could have had a fiscal stimulus by giving everybody money to spend, which would then have ended up in the banks anyway, but at least ordinary people have got to spend it once. If there is a change of government and there's an economic crisis, and I think both are very likely, that is the sort of thing that will have to be discussed, including things like exchange controls, for example. If we've got Brexit and we're out of the EU, we can have exchange controls. Before 1979, and Margaret Thatcher came to power, you couldn't leave this country with more than £1,000 without a chit from the government, and that's called sovereignty.
Okay.
Tell Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Carla, we've also heard this week from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, they're saying that spending is no lower as a share of national income than it was after 11 10 years of Labour government 10 years ago. So this is a headline in The Independent this week. Years of austerity have left the UK with the same level of public spending as it had 10 years ago. So what's been the point of all this?
Really? I hadn't heard that headline, I'm afraid, so I have to plead ignorance on that one.
But, I mean, if... How does it... I mean, maybe you can help here, Martin. Well, how come it's not...
Because a lot of austerity is politically driven. It's designed...
We've had loads of austerity, but IFS are saying we haven't.
Well, we have. We have for poor people, but we haven't for other people. Austerity is a political narrative that allows redistribution from less powerful groups to more powerful groups. And, of course, what happens when you cut spending on schools and kids fail is they end up in prison... So you end up spending money on that anyway. So it's very difficult to cut public expenditure because it's like squeezing a balloon.
One of the things they say in the article, they explain in the article, is that there's much more money being spent by central government on big projects and on specific things that aren't necessarily education than there was under Labour. So that's where the money's going. It's just been diverted away from things like health and education.
The whole austerity narrative is starting to unravel. It's basically a fair tale anyway, but people buy into it. The idea that if it hurts, it must be doing you some good. People are prepared to buy into that for a while because it's to do with psychology and religious ideas that go back to the Reformation and so on. But in actual fact, the AAA credit rating of the country, which the austerity budgets of the coalition government was supposed to protect, was lost because they were trying to cut public expenditure too fast. The economy started to go down, and at that point the deficit automatically rises, so they then had to stop because they'd lost the AAA credit rating. So the whole purpose of the policy is to keep your AAA credit rating, and then you lose your AAA credit rating and everybody's forgotten that.
Anyway,
you just lost the country's
Carla,
it doesn't matter
this,
that much
this affects
they
us
cared
all
about it
very much here in Bristol because of these cuts. We hear that there will be no central government rate support grant at all by 2020, and it seems that Marvin is and Anna, who's just left, the Anna Klanowski, is just have actually implemented a programme to make sure that they're expecting actually no money from central government, and all those cuts are going to be in by 2020. The local authority here in Bristol is simply going to be administering accounts, and most of the services will be privatised if there are any.
That's right.
We're even being told to clean up our own streets now.
Yeah.
So what's the point of paying council tax?
Well, that's right. It used to be that the council got its money from a mixture of a grant from national government, business rates and council tax. And now it's expected to get most of its income from only business rates and council tax, even though most households and many businesses are being affected by austerity. So they're less able to pay, not more able to pay. I really don't know how they're expected to balance the budget based on that. And in going back to what you were saying before about public spending... austerity hasn't hit all government departments equally. In fact, it's hit local government much, much harder than it has many other departments. And that is noticeable and interesting that that's the way the government's chosen
to distribute it. They're talking about, now the latest figures are £111 billion for HS2. So, I mean, you would have thought that that money could have been spent better on keeping essential services going in the country.
Absolutely. Now, of course, there's a difference between capital and revenue, but I'd still much rather see investment on infrastructure to improve local transport in Bristol, certainly, and many other places, before going all out on HS2. I'm not against high-speed rail, but I'm against it if it's at the cost of other public transport, which I think it is.
Okay, so, Martin, do you think there is going to be any kind of solution to this, what seems like bonkers austerity policy, or are we just going to have to wait until the bubble in the stock market goes bang?
Well, there's two possible ways out. One is that there is going to be another crash, and I think there is. Either specific to Britain. Or the other way is we get a change of government and we change the policy. And I think that if we do get a change of government, a change of policy, the idea that you should borrow money when interest rates are low to invest in the future is a coming idea. Across the political spectrum, you can see that the penny's beginning to drop. But of course, if the Chancellor Hammond decides that he's going to go a bit down that road with the budget, he's then undermined the whole purpose of why we've been cutting things for so many years. So I think they're trapped now. They're snookered.
Okay, it's time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour: Green Councillor for Clifton Down, Carla Denyer, former teacher, Christine Townsend, and Dr. Roger Ball from Bristol Radical History Group. Center.